now. Our speaker tonight is very well known to the Foundation, Dr. James Brown, because he's a former Daiwa scholar. He's talking tonight about Japan's thorny relationship with Russia, and he has the expertise on both sides, since, of course, as a Daiwa scholar, he studied Japanese intensively in Tokyo on our scholarship program. But he also has a postgraduate diploma in Russian from the University of Glasgow. He has two master's degrees, one from Edinburgh, one from Aberdeen. Presumably there's a bachelor's in there somewhere.
It's Scottish.
Yeah. And a PhD in international relations from the University of Aberdeen, and has published widely in academic journals, particularly on, I think, Japan-Russian relations. So over to you, James.
Thank you very much.
Right, well, thank you all for coming, and thank you also to the Daiwa Foundation. Really, this book would not have been possible without the Daiwa scholarship. My background, as Jason James was explaining, was very much to do with Russian foreign policy, and it was only thanks to the Daiwa scholarship that I was able to build up my expertise on Japan as well. Anyway, the topic I'm talking about today is this book here. So it came out towards the end of March, and I've been very lucky with the timing. I think sometimes people can be very unlucky with the timing of their books, but in this case, it's a particularly interesting time at the moment for Russia-Japan relations. As many of you will know, on the 6th of May, we're expecting Prime Minister Abe to travel to Sochi for an unofficial summit with President Putin. So one of the main topics they'll be talking about is the absence of a peace treaty between the two sides, and also this territorial dispute. So hopefully I can provide a little bit of background to this topic and explain what some of the thorny issues are here. Okay, so I think it's a very knowledgeable audience. I was having a look through, and I imagine many of you will know the background to this issue, but clearly we're focused. I don't have a pointer, do I? Maybe there's something here, sorry. Okay, so clearly we're talking about this area here. But to go into a little bit more detail, it's the Four Island Dispute. Now, it's not actually four islands, it's three islands and a group of islets. And they're not actually that small. I think that sometimes people can imagine that we're talking about very small amounts of land. Actually, it's really quite significant. The largest of the islands you can see there, 3,280 kilometers squared. Now, if that was returned to Japanese administration, that would actually be the fifth largest of the Japanese islands after the four main islands. And you can see also the comparison there with the Senkaku dispute, where it's only over 6 kilometers squared. So we're talking about significant amounts of territory. A few other details here, just the names. In Russian on the left-hand side, Iturup, Kunashir, Shikotan, and Habomai. And in Japanese, Etorofu, Kunashiri, and then the same for the other two. As for the photo, I include this in particular because it relates to Daiwa. The Daiwa scholarship involves a homestay, and you get to essentially choose where in Japan you're going to spend this month. And given my background in Russian foreign policy, which was the topic of my PhD, I chose to do it as close to Russia as possible. So this is Nemuro in Hokkaido, the northeastern tip of Hokkaido. And the photo here, you probably can't make it out, but there's a sort of brown or kind of dark smudge in the background, which is actually Habomai. And so I spent my month there asking the locals for their opinion on the territorial dispute. I had the opportunity to speak to some of the former residents of the islands, and that really helped to give me a background and an understanding of the Japanese side of this argument. Okay, so that's the basic geographical details. Onto the historical background, and this is crucial to understanding the nature of this dispute. I spent quite a lot of time talking about this in the book, but I want to leave plenty of time for questions, so I'll skip over this relatively quickly. The key thing to focus on to begin with is when diplomatic relations were established between Japan and Russia. That was with the Treaty of Shimoda in 1855. And this is significant because it was at this point that, for the first time, the international border was established between the two countries. And that put it here, placing the four islands, which are now disputed, firmly within Japanese territory. So from the Japanese government's perspective, this is deeply important. This was an agreement which was made voluntarily by the two sides, and the two governments at that time decided that these four islands were part of Japan. Subsequent to this as well, the islands remained with Japan. In 1875, with the Treaty of St. Petersburg, some further issues to do with the border were worked out. Because with the 1855 agreement, whilst the border was established with the Kuril chain, it didn't finalise the status of Sakhalin. That was only achieved with the 1875 Treaty of St. Petersburg, where Sakhalin was recognised as being Russian territory, and in exchange, the full Kuril chain leading right up to Kamchatka was passed to Japan. So this, another agreement between the two sides, and yet still the four islands remain with Japan. And then the final treaty mentioned here, Treaty of Portsmouth, this after the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905, and this is the maximum extent of Japan's territorial possessions vis-a-vis Russia, because southern Sakhalin goes to Japan as well, and the Kuril chain remains with Japan. So all through this period, the four islands, which are now disputed, firmly on the Japanese side. This all changes, of course, with World War II. And as I'm sure you'll all know, during this conflict, for the majority of the time, Japan and Russia, or rather the Soviet Union, are not enemies. They're not fighting each other because of the Neutrality Pact, which was signed between the two of them in April 1941, which says very clearly that in the event of the parties getting involved in a conflict, the two sides, Soviet Union and Japan, will remain neutral for the duration of the conflict. However, this ended in 1945, and on the evening of the 8th of August 1945, Soviet Union declared war on Japan. A few hours later, launching offensives in Manchuria, Sakhalin, and eventually occupying the full Kuril chain, including the four disputed islands, towards the end of that month. So this is significant, of course, because the occupation of the four islands, taking place after Japan had announced its intention to surrender, and indeed the final occupation of Habomai, taking place after the instrument of surrender had been signed at the beginning of September. Other historical things of importance, the San Francisco Treaty of 1951, when Japan renounced all right, title and claim to the Kuril Islands. So you might think that this in a way would settle the dispute in Japan, saying that it was giving up its claim to the islands. However, Soviet Union didn't sign the peace treaty, and further to that, the peace treaty provided no definition of what actually the Kuril Islands were, meaning that subsequent to that, the Japanese government would say that the Kuril Islands refers to the islands north of the four disputed ones, not including all of them down to Hokkaido. So this means that there remains to this day no peace treaty between the two sides. However, it's sometimes suggested in articles that this means that the two countries are still at war, are still in a state of war. That's not correct, because in the Joint Declaration of 1956, it said very clearly that the two sides were agreeing to put an end to the state of war, but postponing for the time being the issue of actually signing a peace treaty. But this is a very, very important agreement. In fact, it was ratified by the legislatures of both sides, meaning that it actually has the status of an international treaty. And that's very important because within that agreement, it sets out a potential deal for solving this long-standing dispute. Because the Soviet side in that agreement said that they would be willing to transfer the two smaller of the islands after the signing of a peace treaty. And the Russian government to this day has stood by this. The Putin administration has said that this is a legal agreement, it was ratified by both sides, and they are willing to uphold it. Okay, so that's the historical background. On to essentially what Japan's position is. So the Japanese government takes the view, this is on the website of the Japanese foreign ministry, saying that these islands are inherent Japanese territory. They were clearly recognized as being Japanese in the 1855 Treaty of Shimoda, but even prior to this, it's argued that they were essentially inherent Japanese territory. They also make the point that the occupation of these islands was opportunistic and illegal. Illegal because it was seen as being in violation of the Neutrality Pact of 1941, and also because there is the view that the Soviet Union's contribution to the war and the victory over Japan was entirely marginal. The narrative is that Japan was already essentially defeated, and the Soviet Union came in at the end essentially just to opportunistically seize territory. Some Japanese academics have described it as the Soviet Union acting like a thief at a fire, or stabbing Japan in the back. And the Japanese government says that they are flexible on how to solve this issue, but essentially that the 1956 proposal is insufficient. The two islands only represent 7% of the total, and they want more than that. So it's not settled exactly what the Japanese government would agree to, but many on the Japanese side have come up with proposals as to what actually could be a viable deal. Most often in the past, the suggestion has been from Japanese administrations that they would like four islands as a batch. The Russian side acknowledging Japanese sovereignty over all four of the islands at once. Others, however, have suggested a slightly more moderate position, suggesting that there could be perhaps a 50-50 split. That would mean that there would be a new international border about here on Etorofu. And that's because Etorofu is so much larger than the other islands. That would actually be 50-50. Others have said that perhaps Etorofu, Iturup could remain with Russia and these three islands could be returned. And others have said that, in fact, the potential solution could be that Japan, first of all, gets these two islands back and then continues to negotiate and has some sort of additional agreement on these. And so kind of differences on the Japanese side as to what the potential solution could be, but all of them agree that the 1956 agreement is insufficient. Okay, now to bring this up to the present day, many Japanese prime ministers have been interested in solving this problem. But I think that Prime Minister Abe is really quite unusual in the amount of attention that he has given to relations with Russia. Ever since his return to power in December 2012, one of the priorities of his foreign policy has been building closer relations with Russia. He made this clear from the very beginning. On the day of his election, or rather the LDP's return to power, he spoke about the importance of relations with Russia. He followed this up by visiting Moscow in April 2013, and that was the first visit by a Japanese prime minister in over 10 years. And subsequent to this, whenever it has been possible, he's looked to build closer relations with Russia. And there are a few reasons for this. But one of the main ones is the hope from Prime Minister Abe that he can be the one to perhaps see a breakthrough in this territorial dispute before he leaves office. And as I say, he's been working on this since he came to power, but it seems that he believes that 2016 could potentially be the year. He's already had some foreign policy successes. Towards the end of 2015, he signed the agreement with South Korea, potentially settling the sensitive comfort women issue. And it seems that with that, in a way, out the way, his new focus for 2016 is on relations with Russia. And he's made no secret of this. Since the very beginning of the year, he's spoken about the need to achieve something on the territorial dispute. In his media appearance, his at the beginning of January, his first media appearance, he spoke about his intention to hold a summit with Russia. He followed this up in a press interview held with the Financial Times and the Nikkei. And also there have been a number of different visits from prominent members of the LDP, including Mr. Komura, that was in January, handing over a personal letter from Prime Minister Abe, and also, quite interestingly, talking about the potential for Japan to act as a bridge between the G7 and Russia, and potentially for Japan, in a way, to represent Russia's interests within the G7. Now, clearly, this buttering up of the Russian side is intended to make it possible to make progress on the territorial dispute. Been phone calls between the two leaders, and also a very interesting development, this one you can see noted 22nd of January, the appointment of a special representative for relations with Russia. And this is Mr. Harada Chikahito, a former Japanese ambassador to Moscow, very knowledgeable about Russia. And it's very unusual to have this position of a special representative. And it's clearly been created explicitly because Mr. Abe believes that this year can be when a breakthrough can be achieved. A few other interesting developments, but to highlight just the final two, a few days ago, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov traveled to Tokyo, held a meeting on the 15th of April with his counterpart, Mr. Kishida. Actually, after that meeting, I met with some Russian diplomats in Tokyo, and they were able to fill me in on some of the details. So perhaps later on, if you're interested, I can speak a bit about that. But all of this was leading up to this meeting scheduled for the 6th of May, when there's going to be an informal summit held in Sochi between the two leaders. Now, you might ask, why is this an informal summit rather than a formal one? The reason being is because it's supposed to be President Putin's turn to go to Japan. He's been invited, but the two sides have been unable to agree on a concrete date for that. And the reason is because of Japan's introduction of sanctions against Russia because of the crisis in Ukraine. So that meant that they weren't bold enough, the Japanese side, to actually settle a date for Putin's visit, but they didn't want to give up on this progress that had been made in relations since 2012. So what they did is they agreed that instead Abe would go to Russia. But it couldn't be an official summit because that would disturb the protocol. Instead, they agreed to make it an informal summit and not in the capital. So that's why they're meeting in Sochi. In a way, however, it suits their interests that it's an informal summit, because it means that there is less pressure on them to actually have a formal declaration at the end, and they don't need to necessarily reveal so much information about what's discussed. So, from the Japanese side, it's seen as an opportunity to actually try and have intensive discussions one-to-one and try and make some progress on the territorial dispute. And it seems to me that Prime Minister Abe is particularly optimistic about what can be achieved. There's the strong belief that Japan has a secure position when it comes to historical and legal issues, some of the issues that I mentioned earlier on. There's also the belief that Japan has a certain degree of leverage over Russia. When you read articles from Japanese academics, they often come back to the issue of Russia needing Japan's help in order to develop Siberia and the Far East, which is a major priority of the Putin administration. They really want to improve the economic conditions of the east of their country. And the Japanese side thinks that maybe this could be a source of leverage. In addition to this, it's often mentioned that despite the superficially excellent relations between Russia and China, there's the belief that underneath that, there are serious concerns from the Russian side about China's growth and its increasing assertiveness. So this leads to the belief that maybe that can also be an incentive for the Russian side to build closer relations with Japan and perhaps compromise on the territorial issue. And other issues as well. Prime Minister Abe seems to have quite strong self-belief about what he can achieve in terms of foreign policy. He's had some relative success. I already mentioned the deal with South Korea. And it seems to be that he feels that he has a real chance. It's often mentioned the belief that he has a relationship of trust and understanding with President Putin, and therefore in a one-to-one negotiation, maybe he could persuade